Thank you very much. Well, thank you for this opportunity. Let me say, before we even begin, let me say a couple of words about myself. My studies and my dissertational work was on the Old Testament in Israel at the Hebrew University. But upon coming to Nyack College, I've been at Nyack College now for I think it's 8 or 9 years. It's a blur after 3 or 4, but after coming to Nyack College, I was there for 2 years, and they began a program, a master's program, which was called Ancient Judaism and Christian Origins. And the director of the program, what he recognized, he actually studied in Israel as well at the Hebrew University, but he realized that in order to understand the New Testament well, you have to, first of all, you have to understand the Old Testament, you have to have a knowledge of Hebrew, you have to have a knowledge of the history, the archaeology, you have to have a knowledge of the geography of the land as well, in addition to the literature created. And so you were left in this kind of intertestamental period, which needs a lot of research in it, but which seldom ever makes it to many churches, because many people just think in terms of the New Testament as, well, you have to know Greek and you have to know the Greco-Roman world. But there is so much more, because the New Testament was written by Jewish people. It was written, there's a lot of Semitic thoughts within it. And so to better understand that, we have to kind of like spend a bit more time digging up just the literary sources and everything else that's encapsulated in there. And that's what I want to try and introduce in the next couple of weeks. I'm calling this the background to the Gospels, and really it is that. I want to add some dimension to what you understand of the Gospels particularly, add some dimension with regards to the historiographical context from which it arose, because it's usually omitted, and we normally think of the New Testament writers as though they wrote in Chicago or Florida, they wrote to us today. But that's not how it happened. They were in a particular environment. They were in a particular social context, which we don't think about. But it affects the way in which we view and which we understand the New Testament today, particularly the Gospels. So with that said, let me start with an overview of the topics I would like to cover. Now, whether this happens, I don't know. But this is the desire, this is my will to try and the things which I want to cover in the next 2 weeks. The first thing is I want to talk about some of the sources that I've used, which are freely available to you, should you so choose, in order to dig up some of the background to the Gospel. So I'll be mentioning that briefly, some of the main places in which you can go. I'll be providing a historical overview, so I'm going to look at the period, I'll discuss that, from, you all know, Ezra and Nehemiah, I hope. Yes, we know Ezra and Nehemiah, that period, that's recorded in the Bible, and then there's a long period of a few hundred years before we get up to Jesus. So I want to cover the history of that period, and it will be relatively brief, but I will cover some of the more important things that happened during that period. And then after that, as I'm going to attempt to do after every one of these short sections, is I'm going to try and make it more relevant to the New Testament. So unlike a sermon, where a sermon you kind of like begin from the Bible and then go out and cover other things, I want to cover the other things first and then narrow in and begin to try and show ways in which the things which I discuss, the things which I raise, then connect with the New Testament and connect with Jesus' life more directly. So we're going to look at a historical overview of that period. I want to quickly mention the linguistic context of the New Testament. And this is quite important because there's been a large shift in research recently, last 10 years, let's say, concerning the linguistic context. And a lot of that hasn't actually made it beyond the academic arena. So there are a couple important things I really want to say there to set, you know, to help you to understand better the context in which Jesus arose and in which he taught. Sects and sectarianism. There's another relatively, so that's going to be a longer section. I want to look at the groups that are around at the time of Jesus. I want to look at the Pharisees. I want to look at the Sadducees. I want to look at the Essenes. I want to look at the Zealots. I want to discuss what was going on, the factions within Judaism. Judaism was not monolithic. In the same sense, even today, we look at Christianity. It's not monolithic. You go to Israel, and for instance, you ask an Israeli, what do you know about Christianity? What do you know about the church? And they'll say, I know that there are Protestants and Catholics. If you're lucky, that's all they're going to say. But they have no idea of that there are Baptists, that there are Reformed, that there are Arminians, that there are Presbyterians. That they have no idea of all of these different factions and how they relate to each other. In the same way, we often look at Jews in the first century and just think in terms of, oh, they were just Jews, the Jews at the time. But there were factions and there were groups among them that existed and interacted with Jesus as well. So when we come to look at this area on sectarianism, I want to look at Jesus to see, did he fit into any one of these groups, or was he totally independent, and did he do something entirely brand new? Thank you very much. He who brings a prophet a glass of water will surely not lose his reward. So yours. Thank you very much. So I want to look at where Jesus fits in and see what he does, which again is, when you look at the data, you might be surprised. I want to take a look at Galilee, the area of the Galilee. I want to take a look at, from the historical geography point of view, we're going to talk about its history. We're going to talk about, because this is where Jesus grew up, its relationship particularly to Judah as well, which is very, very important. Judah's much further south. It's interesting to know where Jesus grew up in relationship to where he was actually crucified at the end of the day. So we're going to talk about that, the distance, and all of the differences that created. We want to look at the Herodian dynasty, the family of Herod the Great, from his grandfather we'll talk briefly about, Antipater, and then Herod, and we're going to talk about his children as well, how the land was divided up, and more importantly, how they interact, or where do we see them in the Gospels and in the book of Acts, and the things that they do. That's another very important thing, as well as what Herod did, how he contributed to the growth and to the success, if you like, of Israel. And then we want to look at Jerusalem and the temple. All of this in 2 weeks. We've got 2 weeks to knock all this stuff down. Jerusalem and the temple. So we want to look at what Jerusalem looked like in the first century. Talk about the various areas, the quarters, some of the places that are mentioned in the New Testament. Jesus' relationship with the temple, particularly, as well as Jerusalem. So we'll be looking into that with lots of diagrams, as well as some archaeological finds that relate to that. And then we'll be looking at Jesus' teaching. Jesus' teaching technique. How did Jesus teach? What are some of the characteristics of his teaching? But perhaps more importantly, how does his teaching fit in to the first century teaching that was going on at the time? Was Jesus doing something incredibly different? Was he doing something very much the same with a small twist? Was he doing something exactly the same as everybody else? Those are the types of questions that we'll be asking in that. So that is approximately where we're going to be going in the next 2 weeks. Unless, of course, if there's something that you feel I've missed out here, there's more which I could add, but I haven't done, because I think this is enough. But if there's something particularly that you want to know about, please let me know. I have another week. I've got quite a lot of material in this area, so I should be able to wind something in. Some people like to know about the Dead Sea Scrolls, which I thought may have been a bit too much. But again, if you have an interest, I can do it. Great. So let's begin the journey. The sources, some of the sources that I have used. You will see throughout the slides, there will be quotations that I'm using, and most of them are going to be from the sources that we're going to see now that are very important. So I will go through them, and they will be freely available. Well, they are freely available. So concerning the sources, ancient sources for history. One place which I go is the book of Maccabees, Maccabees 1 and 2. The book of Maccabees, freely available, and it used to be in our Bibles just about 300 years ago. It's part of the Apocrypha, what's called the Apocrypha. And some of you, I'm sure, know this, but when the King James Version of the Bible was originally produced in 1611, the Apocrypha was part of that Bible. It was actually one of the, it was a section that all of the books of the Apocrypha were in the middle of the King James Bible. And it was only after about 100 years or so that they actually pulled it out. But the book of Maccabees really covers the Maccabean revolt. We'll talk about that. It covers that historical period. And it very much is a book that speaks very favorably of the Maccabean dynasty, of this family who rebelled against Greece. And it speaks very favorably of them. So whenever we're looking at historical sources, any historical source, and this is just a general piece of advice, we have to think about who wrote it and why was it written. We always have to keep that in mind because that will skew how the writer portrays events. So that's a very, very important question. And that concerns any history book you read at all. You've got to think who wrote it and why was it written. And I can testify that to we learned about American history when we first came here. We came here from the UK. And we homeschooled our girls for the first year, and we were teaching them about American history, and they, within the history, they spoke of an incident that happened in Boston Harbor involving lots of tea, which is very interesting, because when we read about the same historical context from England, it was very, very different. The story was very, very different. The same story, the same incident, but two sides, a large divide of water, changes the way in which it's perceived. So if you're thinking that that's happening now, it's also happening back then, that you can have one incident, two incidents, but two different people perceive it very, very differently. So we always have to be a little bit kind of like, not suspicious, but inquiring of the sources that we read. So that's the book of Maccabees. Josephus is probably the most important. This is Josephus here. A depiction of him. Josephus was a Jew who began, we'll talk about revolt in a minute, but he began working with the Jewish revolt, the first Jewish revolt against Rome, and he was sent as a general to defend the cities of the Galilee, the north. And so he was working for the Jews, and then when the village or the town that he was set to defend against, when they got overrun by the Romans, Josephus was able to smooth talk his way out of any kind of punishment, and he began to follow them to document the work the Roman revolt, them quelling the Roman revolt. He worked with Vespasian, who was the emperor at the time, and he went around. And he was he was a historian recording what happened, but he was also very much wanting to promote Jewish literature, to promote the Old Testament at the time, and everything Jewish. So much of what he wrote is, again, it has this slant of advertising and selling Jews and Judaism as being this very noble people, and being on a par with the Greeks and the Romans, with regards to literature and sophistication. The two volumes predominantly used that he wrote, one of them is called Antiquities of the Jews, which covers, it goes all the way back and it recounts from Genesis all the way through to his contemporary period. So it covers a lot of that history. And then he does another volume called The Jewish Wars, which covers mainly, it describes the wars, it describes Herod the Great, it describes the Roman conquest, but it mainly covers a later period of history. But those are the two main volumes that I will be using. Philo of Alexandria, I use occasionally. Philo is a little bit different because Philo was a Jew, but he lived in Egypt, in Alexandria, which was miles and miles away. So Philo, he wrote a number of huge volumes, some of which covered history. He had a knowledge, he only visited Israel once, so he kind of had a vague knowledge of the land, but it wasn't that good. But he does shed some light on the Essenes, who we'll be talking about, and the group who we suppose wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then we have the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves, which is another source. All of the Dead Sea Scrolls, contrary to popular belief, are available for you to read. They've all been published. There are no secret scrolls hidden in the Vatican or hidden in Hebrew University Library or anything like that. That's all a myth. That's all a story, which I could go into, but I won't. But oh, they're all available. But a number of the Dead Sea Scrolls, particularly the scrolls written by the Dead Sea community, let's say the Essenes, they can shed a lot of light on the history of the period, of what was going on. Then we have the Mishnah. Now the Mishnah, I don't suppose that not many people ever touch the Mishnah. It's one of those books. In the same way that we find in Israel, you go to the Hebrew University and 99% of the professors there are scared to touch the New Testament. They're phobic about the New Testament. No one's allowed to touch it or read it at all. Some are, my professor was, but in the same way, there's a phobia about the Mishnah. The Mishnah is a Jewish religious book. It was written, codified around about the 2nd or 3rd century, but it reflects a lot of what happened in the 1st century and before. A lot of the traditions are there. Now, the Mishnah particularly, as opposed to the Talmud, the Mishnah is a relatively early book. It was from about 2nd century, you could say it was really codified, but it was written as a response to the first Roman defeat, the destruction of the temple in AD 70. So that's when things started to come together, and there are stories about that I won't go into now. But within the Mishnah, there are some excellent descriptions of the temple, of Jerusalem and what it looked like, of teaching customs, of people. There's some very, very good historic descriptions within there. And so that it should be used as a historical source. So those are the main sources I use. Plus, I'll be obviously using the New Testament as well. But these are some of the extra biblical texts that I'll be using to help us through this time. Any questions so far? I'm going to stop for questions every now and again. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's seen as being, this is the perception, but it's seen as being a book that is anti-Jewish, that speaks negatively against all Jews, and there's kind of a taboo about it because people are scared that if you read the New Testament, then you will become a Christian. And so, yeah, you laugh, but that's the kind of ideas and the notions that are about it. It's even from even within Judaism, there are places that speak negatively against New Testament traditions and against Jesus as well. So kids are really taught to stay away from it, and people are told, "Oh, it's a Christian book. Don't read that." And that's, sorry. Oh yes. Oh, definitely, definitely, definitely. Yeah. Living in Israel, you know, I've seen that at work. Not everybody is like that. My advisor was very much, he had a copy of the New Testament in Hebrew on his desk. He kept it on his desk, and he was happy to say, because he very much saw it as being a Jewish book, which it is. But it's not viewed like that amongst many, many Jews, particularly the Orthodox communities. Yeah. Yes, yes, it absolutely is. Yes, it is. It absolutely is. It is, I mean, it definitely is. I fully agree with that. And it's very interesting that, on a similar parallel but lesser level, how many Christian scholars will not touch the Mishnah? under similar grounds. That's a Jewish book. We don't care about that. We have enough, and they won't touch it. So they'll read Herodotus and all that, but they won't touch the Mishnah, Christian scholars. And it's kind of like, it's a silly kind of you never know where these things happen. You never know where they come from, but you can begin to scratch the surface of that kind of, and it is ignorance that you have. But within Judaism, I think it's more ingrained and it's more built in, and so you won't find to say positively about it. There's an interesting video series called One for Israel. You should look on YouTube, One for Israel. And it's run by Israel College of the Bible. And they have 5-minute videos of Jews that come to Messiah. And one of the most popular things that they say is they read the New Testament and they were surprised how Jewish it was. Regards to the customs, with regards to the Hebraisms within the text, and they were all surprised how much they just hadn't read it before. They were told they don't read it, but when they do, it's life changing. It very much is life changing. One for Israel, very good series to actually read. Yeah, there are a couple professors who would say and agree with that very much, but they are very few. I knew two. Professor Yair Zakovich and Professor Emmanuel Tov. I knew those two, only those two. And I've been in, heavyweight like conferences with a lot of Hebrew University professors. And I have seen them stand up and defend against the crowd, defend the Jewishness of the New Testament. I've seen them do that. So that's, they're outliers. The majority of thinking is very much, this is a Christian thing, don't read this, otherwise you're going to become a Christian, or worse, you become a Catholic, which is what they say. That's what they know. That's what they recognize. Any more questions? So I'll stop after each section. I'll probably stop and ask some questions. Ask for questions. Good. I'm obviously moving too close to something. Okay. Stay like this then. Okay. This is a historical overview of the period. We're going to go through this bit by bit, but I wanted you to see what it looks like all the way from the beginning through to the end. Is this on over here? I don't know if that's on. But anyway, this is basically where we're going to be going. So I will break it down and we'll talk about each of the individual levels piece by piece. We're going to begin really with Cyrus. Cyrus was a Persian king, and it was Cyrus who defeated the Babylonians. If you go way back into the Old Testament days, we know that there was an exile in which the Babylonians came, and they captured Judah, they destroyed Judah, and they exiled them over to Babylon. That was Nebuchadnezzar. He was the emperor in charge at that time. After that, the Persians defeated the Babylonians under the rule of Cyrus. And one of the things Cyrus did was that he allowed the Jews to return back to their homeland from Babylon. He allowed them to go back. And there's the Cyrus cylinder, which declares, which makes this declaration, which is an artifact found. But that's an Old Testament issue, so I'm not going to go into that. So he allowed the Jews to return, but the Persians still ruled. As a result of the exile, the Israelites lost all of their autonomy. They were no longer a kingdom. They never had a king anymore. So when they went back, it was, like I said, about 10% of the Jews that went back, a large number of Jews still lived in Babylon. And we're going to come back to those because they have an impact later on in the days of Herod the Great. So Cyrus allows them to come back, and they set up a small district within the kingdom of Israel, right here, the district of Judah. And that's basically where they came back to. Now, if you think about this, your people coming back here, but in their memory, or in their, you know, from the traditions that they would have been told, once upon a time, back in the days of King David and King Solomon, Israel was all of this land up here. That's what they had. They had access to the coast and the king's highway. They had access much further down south. Some of the kings had access all the way down to Elat. When they come back, they have this tiny little patch of land. And this piece of land is highly deceptive, because you're looking at a green patch of land and you're thinking, okay, that's not so bad. But a lot of this is in fact desert. It's the Judean desert and the Judean hills. So the piece of land that they actually get back is very, very small and incredibly insignificant. So that kind of creates a bit of a problem when they do return. Jerusalem, which ultimately during the days of Hezekiah was this kind of size, was up to this size, was now this size here when they came back. That's another picture of Jerusalem. So it was all of this, but when Nehemiah comes back to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, this is what he's rebuilding. And all of this out here was destroyed from the Babylonian captivity. Not only that, but obviously the temple had been destroyed and decimated as well. So they come back, 10% of the people come back to a decimated land. The walls of Jerusalem had been knocked down and destroyed. The temple had been destroyed. And it's more than just the temple being destroyed. You have to think the temple was a place where God lived. It was his address on earth. And so there, it's almost as though there, you know, God had been, God's house had been knocked down. And so they've come back and they have to deal with this psychologically, deal with this from a religious point of view. What are they going to do? How are they going to get things back? So that's basically what they came back to during the reign of Cyrus. And I'll say one thing as well, just going back to, let's go back to this map here. At the time they did return, it was a large number of people, but the controlling district was Samaria. That was the main, this area here is better populated, but they were the controlling people. They were the people who had the most charge over all of this area here. So the people of Samaria were the dominant force. They had lived there all the time. During the exile, they escaped the exile. They lived there all of the time. Then all of a sudden, there's an influx of Jews coming in from Babylon to live in this area to rebuild the temple, to rebuild Jerusalem, and repopulate the area. So this is part of the clash. We'll talk about the Samaritans later on, but this forms part of the angst or the conflict between the Samaritans and the Jews, because now all of a sudden they're being overtaken. It's like, you know, if you live in a neighborhood and all of a sudden, you know, a bunch of foreign people come in, you start to feel threatened, you start to feel, hey, who are you guys anyway? And tensions begin to build up. So that's a very important thing to remember, and we will come back to it. So we go through Persian rule. They take over the whole, you know, pretty much the known world. They are the dominant force. Then in about 333 BC, all of these are BC dates before Christ, so we're kind of, the numbers are getting smaller, but we are in fact still moving forward. Keep that in mind. We then enter into a period of Greek rule. And that is basically when Alexander the Great comes in from Macedonia. He adopts the dream of his father, which is to conquer the whole of the known world. And Alexander the Great, by all accounts, was a genius, an absolute genius. And I don't know, there are stories of, legendary stories of him apparently knowing the names of everybody in his army. So he could go out and he could encourage them. But he was very much, though he was young, he was a very dynamic and he was very much a loved leader for the most part of his life up until towards the end when he wanted to go on and conquer further parts of Asia, and his men just said, that's enough, and then they abandoned him. But that's, you know, this is the story of Alexander the Great. So Alexander the Great came in from the west, conquering the Persian Empire. And when he came over here, we're going to be over here from Macedonia. He came via Turkey, and then he pushed back the Persian army just here, just around about here. And then he went down to conquer this area of Israel. It wasn't Israel at the time, but he went down the coast to defeat all of the cities down here, and then he conquered Egypt. Now, he had to do that because the Persians still had some support, military support, from people in Ashdod, Dor, and Tyre. So he didn't want to go fighting against the Persians and have these guys chasing his back. So he had to conquer all the way down here. And that's exactly what he did. He didn't receive that much resistance. Only, I think, Tyre created a bit of resistance for him. And I believe Ashdod did as well. But apart from that, he went straight down. Now, at this stage, Alexander the Great doesn't really care too much about what happens in Israel, Jerusalem. Jerusalem is nothing. It is a broken down city. It has religious significance for a few of these Jewish people, whoever they are, but it really isn't important. We do have an account of Josephus that states that Alexander the Great went up to Jerusalem and was met by some of the priests, and the priests opened up to him the book of Daniel, because within Daniel, it prophesies Alexander the Great conquering the world. So apparently they showed him the book of Daniel and said, you're that famous leader, and everything was really, really cool, but he didn't conquer them or anything like that, and then he went back. So there's a record of a brief visit of Alexander the Great there. Now, did he actually do it? I don't know. I really don't know. It was Josephus talking. I'm not sure. But that's the only real contact that we have of Alexander the Great and Jerusalem. So it's not really important. Jerusalem's not important. Judah is not important. What was important was the coastal areas down here, because they contained the ports, which controlled the sea fleets. So that having the sea became a very big issue, and they were the hardest places to conquer. So we have Alexander the Great. He conquers, but still at this time, nobody's talking about Jerusalem and Judah. Nobody really cares. It's a small backwater. We don't hear anything about it during Alexander the Great's rule. He then dies. Where he died is uncertain. Babylon, Persia, it's uncertain, but he grows sick and he dies. When Alexander the Great dies, there is a problem because he doesn't name a successor. So he dies under some strange circumstances. It's difficult to get to the bottom of that, even from the wealth of historical sources we do have. But when he dies, there becomes naturally a power vacuum and a power grab. And so we find three of his generals, actually it's four, but we're mainly going to be concerned with three. Three of his generals, Ptolemy, Seleucid, and Antigonus, they race to grab control of his kingdom. We are mainly going to be concerned with these two, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. They race to grab hold of his kingdom. This is it. These two peoples, these two kings, leaders, generals, they're actually called the Diadochi. This is called the period of the Diadochi, which is the generals, when the generals ruled over Israel. And I'm calling it Israel now just for the sake of argument. I could call it the Levant, but I'm going to call it Israel. After Alexander died, Ptolemy the First, one of his generals, took over, and he reigned from Egypt going up into Israel as well. So he reigned from Egypt all the way up to Israel. And then beyond that in Syria, that was by another general creating the Seleucid dynasty. So Israel was reigned by the Ptolemies. All of this is still under Greek rule. still under Greek rule. Whilst the Greeks were ruling, one ruler in particular by the name of Antiochus IV, he was determined to try and take back all the lands of his predecessor, of Alexander the Great. And so maybe I should take a step back to mention that after I think it was Antiochus III came, back to Egypt. So the Seleucids controlled Israel for a good 50, 60, 70 years. Now, going back to Antiochus IV, one of the things he did, he was keen to Hellenize the whole of Israel. And it's, there are various accounts, various different perspectives of the story, but it came to the point where there were those in Israel who were opposing him. And so he came back from an attempted battle against Ptolemy IV, I think it was, and he came back, and there was a bit of an uproar in Jerusalem. And so he wanted then to stamp out Judaism, stamp out the religion of Israel. And so he came back angry with his soldiers, and he went to the temple, and he forced the sacrifice of a pig to Zeus in order to desecrate the temple. And not only that, but he went around the whole of Judah forcing people to bow down and to worship Zeus. This created a problem at this time. And there was one family who rose up in a place called Modi'in, which is just outside Jerusalem. They rose up and they said, no, we need a place for the Jewish people to worship God. And the father, a very respected figure, Mattathias, who was a Hashmonim, who was a Hasmonean, he was quite old at the time, but they went through Roman soldiers, came through his village to Modi'im, and they were making people make sacrifices and worship Zeus. He saw someone doing this, and he said no, and they turned to him, and they said, make your people worship Zeus. And he said, no, I will not do that. And then him and his family there began a huge revolt against the Greeks, a big revolt against the Greeks. And he had a large family. This is the Hashmonean dynasty. This is a very important dynasty. These were Jews, began with Mattathias. Then his sons took control, and they have a bit of a dynasty going all the way down to Hyrcanus, Alexander Yanai. These are important figures, but it goes all the way down to probably about Antigonus and Alexander, to round about here, where their rule comes to an end, and that's when we have the event of Herod the Great. We're going to talk about Herod the Great more and how he relates to them. But this family was very important, was instrumental in reshaping the whole paradigm, reshaping Israel. It began with Mattathias. They had major, major, major effect on Israel at the time. And some of the things we have to keep in mind, and we'll talk about this obviously at the end of the summary, because it all connects at the end of the day. One of the things that happens is that the temple was cleansed. I'd said that it was sacrificed. They sacrificed a pig. They desecrated it, the whole of the temple, and they stopped the daily sacrifices back in the days of Antiochus IV. One of the things that happens is that the temple is cleansed. When Judas comes back, one of the sons, let's go back here, Judah Maccabee here, he comes, they begin this rebellion, they come back and they take Jerusalem. One of the things he does is he comes into Jerusalem, and this is the one part at least that we need to bear in mind. When he comes into Jerusalem, he comes in and all of the crowds are waving palm branches. And they are saying, hallelujah, hallelujah, you have come to cleanse the temple. That's what they were doing when he came back to cleanse. And he cleanses the temple, and there's a story of Hanukkah, because they'd run out of oil, and they had a tiny little piece of oil, and then they used that oil, and it lasted for, I think it was nine or ten days, this miraculous piece of oil they used, and that obviously generates the basis of the Festival of Lights, Hanukkah, which we find Jesus actually worshipping in as well. But that basically surrounds this event here. That's clearly an important thing, because it's on the minds of people in the gospel period. A man is coming to cleanse the temple, to set things right, and he's coming as this kind of savior figure to reclaim the temple and Jerusalem once again, to make it everything good and pure and right as it should be. So he comes in and he does that. So the temple is cleansed, the sacrifices, the daily sacrifices are being offered once again, and Jews have control over Jerusalem. So they get rid of all of the Greek soldiers from there. Also, what happens during the reign is that Israel gains its independence once again. Now, you have to read, like I said before, you have to always read between the gaps. The book of Maccabees is the story in which we have all of this. But when you look at them, you have to understand that Rome at this point was growing in power and authority. They hadn't taken over the area yet. And we see that there are correspondences between Rome and the Maccabean family, because I don't think that by themselves they could have done all that they did without some kind of help and support from Rome, or without them knowing. So there is a connection there. But irrespective of that, Israel becomes independent once again with their own rulers and their own leaders. And ultimately, as we go down the family lines, we find that the Maccabean leaders start to call themselves kings. So it's going back and it's recovering this idea, this dream of the kingdom of Solomon and of David, of a united Israel. It's coming back again. Israel also increases its territory. I'd mentioned at the beginning that the original idea was that Mattathias wanted to have a small area where Jews could be Jews. Well, they could celebrate what they wanted to celebrate without any interruption of these horrible Greeks. That's how the idea began. Now, if we look at this map here, we can see it goes from dark green, which is what the Jews originally had, and the light green, we see that at some stage, there is a change in thought, and it's no longer about just having a little piece of land where we can worship, but it becomes conquest. It becomes recovering the dream of Solomon and David and the great kings of Israel. And we find that during the Hasmonean era, they conquer this area up here and down there. Later kings, they expand over here. Later kings expand all the way down here, around here, expanding up here, going all the way up this way, up into the Galilee as well. Previous to that, the Galilee, we're going to talk about the history of the Galilee, but previous to that, the Galilee was not well populated at all. There were few peoples running about, most of them Gentiles. But during the Hasmonean time, we find that they conquer much of the Galilee, all of this territory here. And so the land expands, they gain so much more, and now all of a sudden it's looking more like what it was back in the days of the great kings of Israel. Something else happens which creates a bit of a problem. The Hasmoneans begin to call themselves, I think it was the days of Alexander Yanai, certainly by his days, Aristobulus and John Hyrcanus, around about this sort of time, the Hasmoneans begin to call themselves king and priest. They take over the high priesthood as well. So now the king and the high priest have been united into one role. And during this period, it creates a problem because there are real priests who know that the two should never be reunited and that the king should basically be, should come under the priest in many respects, according to the book of Deuteronomy. So during this period, during this forcible taking of the all the leadership roles, because the priest was responsible as well administratively during those days, during this period we find that there's a more pronounced breaking away for the factions within Israel. And this is the period in which we find the Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes. This is really where they develop, and many people believe it was because the Hashemites did this that created all of these factions and created these kind of like religious groups amongst the nation of Israel. So they reunite those two roles. The sects develop, as I just mentioned, particularly the Essenes, we think, began at this time also. And Jerusalem is rebuilt and expanded. We're going to talk about the Jerusalem. It was that skinny strip of land that I showed you before, but it expands and the walls are created. They're much larger. But we'll talk about that once we talk more about Jerusalem. The temple as well was rebuilt in many stages. And this is another issue that we have. People talk about the first and the second temple. The first temple being the Solomonic temple, which was destroyed at the Babylonian exile. But the temple, the story of the temple is a bit more complicated than that, because the temple was kind of like a small version of it was rebuilt by Ezra during his days. It was desecrated, and then it was kind of rebuilt again by the Hashmoneans. And then when Herod the Great comes, he rebuilds and redesigns everything again. So the temple kind of like, there are three or four different temples that were reconstructed on the same space, but they looked quite different, and they were in different stages of repair throughout the second temple period. So the temple is rebuilt at this particular time, and the Hashmoneans sit pretty much within, still kind of within Greek rule. That's where they sit, that's where they exist. But they just took over the land of Israel and became independent, and they ended up making treaties with Greece, with the Greek rulers, saying, you know, we're not going to take no more land, you leave us alone. But they gained independence. And this is huge. The thought and memory of this is enormous in the times of Jesus. And you must never, ever underestimate what they accomplished from the small region district into a nation once again, a proud nation once again. So we have the Hashmoneans ruling over Israel with the Greeks over the surrounding areas. And then we have in 63 BC, we have the Roman ruler Pompey, who comes over after, basically there's a bit of unrest in the area. And Pompey comes and defeats the Greeks and overcomes the Hashmoneans as well, and they lay stake to Israel. So that nation that they fought over, the autonomy that they had created, the wonderful kingdom that they had, was snatched from underneath their noses by the Romans. Now all of a sudden we have taxes. Now all of a sudden we have Roman garrisons positioned all over the place. We have Roman soldiers being placed right on the temple complex virtually. They're everywhere. And now all of a sudden the freedoms that they had under the Hashmonean rule has been taken away by these Romans. Pompey did it, and he sets up we're going to talk about this, he sets up Herod, or the Herodian family, to look after Israel, to manage it, to make sure the taxes come in on time. Herod is kind of like a strange, individual. Why? He's strange because during the Hashmonean rule, one of the Hashmoneans, a man by the name of Hyrcanus, he, in expanding expanding Israel, he conquered a group called the Idumeans. The Idumeans, and they lived south of Judah. And he conquered them, and according to the records, he forced circumcision upon them. So they were Gentiles, he forced circumcision upon them, and he made them join his army. But they were not Jews, natural born Jews. They were forced into conversion. One of those who was forced into conversion was Antipater, who was not Jewish, but he comes into the Hasmonean army as an important general. He has a son, Antipater, who's also, again, of this same line, who's not fully Jewish, and he has another son, who is Herod the Great. So Herod the Great's ancestry is not, he's not kosher. Okay, he's kind of Jewish. They were forced into conversion, but he's not kosher. So he was never properly accepted as being fully Jewish. So he's kind of like this kind of half-breed, and he was given command over the land of Israel. And he was given a rule over it, and he actually, through wheelings and dealings, we're going to talk more about him and the rule of his sons, but through wheelings and dealings, he actually expanded Israel. But he was still very much a servant of the Romans. He understood that's where the power was. And so he was primarily working for them and himself, but he did benefit the land of Israel as well. And that's, again, something we'll talk about more and more when the time comes. So that's Herod the Great, Pompey. He comes in. This is a summary of his family tree. We have Herod the Great here. I didn't do his father and grandfather, but we have Archelaus, Philip, Antipas. Those are the main three who actually take on territory when he dies. We have another son, Aristobulus, who has another son, Herod Agrippa, who ultimately unifies all of the territory of these three individuals. We'll talk more about them once we talk about the Herodian dynasty, but Archelaus was, you can see he was given this land here, originally when Herod died. And we find Archelaus mentioned in the Gospels at Jesus' birth. He was a very cruel leader. He didn't last very long either. Soon after he took over, he was too cruel. The people began to revolt, and so he was deposed, and his kingdom was taken from him, and they brought in some Roman procurators to manage the land. And the procurators were basically Romans who had fought in wars, they were old, they were about to retire, and so they ended up managing districts like this. They would tax people quite heavily, gain a lot of money, and then they would retire. And we see in the list of procurators that managed this area of Archelaus, they stay there for about 3, 4, 5 years, and then they're gone. 3 or 4, 5 years, and they're gone. So we see this quick succession, and amongst the procurators, of course, is Pontius Pilate. That was his role. He was there to manage this area of Archelaus, whereas we have another one of his sons, Antipas, has this area up here and this area down here. He remains in power, and we hear about Herod, Jesus calling him that fox. He is the same Herod who beheaded John the Baptist as well, but he remains in power while Archelaus is taken away, and Philip is given this piece of land up here, which is really mainly Gentiles, so we don't have Jesus going up there at all, but Philip is mentioned in the Gospel accounts. So they're basically the sons of Herod. That's how the land was divided at the time, all during Roman rule. Two more incidents happened that are very important that we have to be aware of. One of them is this, the destruction in AD 70. In AD 66, a revolt against the Romans began. This is after Jesus died. the Jews had had enough. There had been a number of the taxes were too high. There were more Roman procurators attempting to pillage the temple, and it sparked off a revolt. In this revolt, it lasted 4 years. There was an attempt by the Romans to overcome it, and they were their armies basically, they made it as far as Jerusalem, and they were pushed back and defeated by the Jewish rebels. And then Rome went away, and they hired in the big guns. They brought in Vespasian, and Vespasian came in with his son Titus, and they decimated the whole of the country. They came back from the north, they destroyed a lot of the Galilee, they came down, they surrounded Jerusalem from two sides, and they come into Jerusalem, and they totally destroy the temple. They tip, they literally turn it over stone by stone. And if you remember what Jesus said when the disciples pointed out, oh, what large stones, Jesus said, I tell you, not one stone will be left on top of another. And this is what he was actually speaking about. Now, I'll say something as well about this, something that happens during this period, it would seem. There's a wonderful story called the Flight to Pella, in which when the Roman army surrounded Jerusalem, there was a small conclave of Christians, of believers, believing Jews, who saw the Roman army surrounding Jerusalem. And apparently they had remembered the words of Jesus, when you see the armies on the hills, to flee to the hills. And they apparently escaped from Jerusalem and went to a place called Pella, which is over in the Jordan. And many people believe that they responded directly to the words of Jesus. And this is one of the reasons which causes or has caused the great split within Judaism and Christianity. The fact that these Jews, this group of Jews, didn't hang around, but they fled away from the signs of trouble. So the temple is destroyed. Judaism reshapes itself under Yehuda, Judah Hanasi, Judah the Prince. He goes up north and he begins codifying and writing what was Pharisaic Judaism, and that's how we get the creation of the Mishnah. So we have that in AD 70. After that, there's an aftermath. Jews begin to come back. They don't really rebuild the temple anymore, but they come back and they gather in strength up until a bit later. This here is just a picture of where we went. Some of you seen that? Familiar? These are the stones that were basically tipped up from the up here of the temple that came down here during the destruction. So that destruction in AD 70, there is still evidence of that today. All of them being tipped over. So we have later on, after the Jews gain strength, they have another revolt, the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135 AD. Once again, an individual, a Jewish individual, by the name of Shimon. His name, they say, was Shimon Bar Kosiva, which means the son of a lie. But they changed his name to Bar Kokhba, which means literally the son of a star. And this goes back to a prophecy in Numbers 20-something, I think it is. And it's a messianic prophecy. And he was one of the individuals who, or other people at least, proclaimed him to be the Messiah. And he led a revolt against Rome, and they wanted to reclaim the temple for themselves again. He started to mint his own coins, and he really had quite a following behind him up until the Romans said, no, we don't want any of that. And then the Rome came and they led a sustained war of attrition, which lasted years, but it ultimately meant that the Jewish people were dispelled. They were expelled from Jerusalem. Hadrian, the emperor at the time, took over Jerusalem. He went to the temple. He destroyed the temple and he rebuilt a temple to a god. I can't remember what it was now. They renamed the city Aelia Capitolina, and they totally revamped the city, chased away all of the Jews, another failed revolt. So that is basically a history of the period. And so just to shut off this particular section, I want to talk about the relevance that this has to the Gospels and the New Testament, because this very much sets a stage for what goes on and influences how we understand the New Testament. One thing it does is that is language. Throughout this period, something very important happens. Through the years of Alexander the Great, when he came and conquered the land, he brought with him Greek culture and Greek language. And Greek, during the years of Alexander the Great and afterwards, becomes a language that everybody understands across the whole world. This is important because it forms a platform for the gospel. That's the way I see it. It forms a platform whereby the gospel message is no longer going to be restricted to one speaking group, but it goes out into all of the world. So the Greeks lay down this foundation, and that's what we have. That's why the New Testament is in Greek. But it lays down this foundation where the gospel message can spread, and it's no longer limited to one language and one people. So that's a huge importance. The foundation is laid for the gospel to be successful. And everything that happens really up until the time of the Gospels, I think, very much serves as watering the ground and making it fertile and ready so that when the Gospel comes, it is in the best place to flourish. So we have language. We have travel infrastructure. The Romans came and they created roads. All roads lead to Rome. Well, they were building all the roads. So they figured, and we figured if you find a road, it's going to have to lead there at some stage. But they created this travel infrastructure, you know, which is still visible today, in which not only was language therefore easy, but it was easy to travel to the farthest parts of the world. So once again, there's an area of preparation for the gospel to come. And it's only through this that Paul is able to travel all the way to Rome, as well as to various other places as well. So we have that support system being created. The Roman occupation, we find that in the Gospels. You need to understand that the Rome being in Israel is a pain. The Jews had it set perfect. They had their kingdom. They had their land. They had control over everything. They had the and now Rome was there. What they had was taken away from them. And so the tension between the Jews and Rome remains strong, with Israel still thinking someday they can get it back again. Another idea which occurs, which is in the minds of the Jewish people that we see, is that revolts work. If we stand against the opposing force, we can win. The Hashmoneans did it. They chased away the Greeks. They did it. And so within the gospel context, we find the thought is still there. And we're going to talk about one of the sects that really adopted that thought and took it a long way. But they think we can win. It can happen. And we saw later on as well, during the Bar Kokhba revolt, the idea of revolt against Rome, against the power, can work. That's what he's thinking. And also in the first revolt, they're thinking it can work. And this is going on all of the time amongst the Jewish people. There's a large section of society thinking, you know, we can do this. We can overthrow them. And so we find on the other end of that, there's a degree of Roman intolerance. Rome knows what they are thinking. And so any sign of rebellion, they have to crush very, very quickly and very, very harshly. Any sign. And so Rome has a heavier presence in Israel. They have, like I said, a presence. They have the fortress of Antonia, you'll see in Jerusalem. They had a small barracks right on the edge of the temple complex. Any sign of rebellion must be quelled. And it's obviously what Jesus is caught up in. he is seen as being somebody who is a rebeller, who is a troublemaker. They have to get rid of him. So all of this, in this attitude by Rome towards the Jews, contributed to Jesus being crucified. And the other aspect as well is the whole idea of Hellenism, which comes in, and there's tension with that as well. When I speak of Hellenism, I'm talking about the influences of the Greco-Roman world that they were bringing in, the good and the bad. And there's always a conflict within society. Some people like it, some people don't. We see Hellenism is like what it happens in churches, where young people are bringing in newfangled ideas of how we should be worshiping and what we should be doing. And there's always a hard core of the older people who will say, no, we should not be doing that. And there's always this tension caused on when these new ideas are flooding into a particular system. The same ideas were going on, the same tension was in Israel as well. And perhaps most of all, throughout just about all of the sects, there was an idea of messianic hope. There was an idea of a leader who was going to arise, not in the same way that we see the Messiah, but who was going to make it right. Not just in the sense of the Hasmoneans, but certainly in that mold, somebody who could be king and priest at the same time, but somebody who was going to not just get rid of the Romans, but he was going to bring equality, he was going to bring balance, he was going to bring justice and righteousness so that people would be living once again under the power and conquest of King David, but under the righteous judgments of King Solomon. So all of these ideas are woven into the New Testament, even before we've read anything. And as you read through the New Testament, I'm hoping as you go through it, you're going to be able to see some of these things popping up in discussions and some of the actions of individuals. So right there, that's going to end this particular section. Questions, please. Oh, yes. That's a good question. Does that mean that the New Testament was written in Greek and not in Hebrew? That's a good question. I'm going to be touching upon that actually on the next language profile of Israel. But for now, I will say this. We believe it was written in Greek by Hebrew thinkers. By Hebrew thinkers. And there's a big difference there. That makes a big difference. And so, I'll talk a little bit about something called Hebraisms, which is Greek that doesn't work well, Greek that doesn't work well in Greek, but works better in Hebrew. I'm sure you must have that going between Cantonese or Mandarin and English. But I have a situation where I have one daughter who she was obviously born in Israel, but she's gifted at languages. She's very good at languages, and languages kind of like soak into her so much more. But Hebrew is really her first language. That is a language that has really soaked into her, and it affects how she speaks English. And so she makes statements like, "I'm afraid from the dark." I'm afraid from the dark, if she wrote that down, you say, well, that's bad English, because you don't say I'm afraid from the dark, you say I'm afraid of the dark, a different preposition. But in Hebrew, you say, I'm afraid from the dark, and I'm afraid miha hoshech. And so she is using the Hebrew syntax in English, and that's the kind of like a Hebraism. So we see lots of that going on with the New Testament. So though it's Greek, the person who was thinking about it obviously knows Hebrew, and that's affecting how he's translating it. But we're gonna come to that in a second. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Intuitive. It's a good question. How would you quantify how much? That's the question. I couldn't quantify and say, you know, 50%, 60%. I can say there are aspects of Greek culture in there, but I can say I would say that the majority of what we know from the New Testament has to be understood from a Hebrew and a Jewish background. That's what I would say, the majority. So whether that's 60%, 70%, 80%, 80%, I don't know. But there is more Jewish and Hebrew in the New Testament than there is Greek culture. That I do know. The Greeks, they give things a lot of names, but when we talk about Jesus' teachings, we talk about his actions, we talk about that's so much of that is fits so much better in a Jewish context than it does in a Greek context. So much of it. And we'll talk about it. We'll see this will come out when I talk about the parables. When we speak of some of the inscriptions, we'll see that as well. And hopefully that would clarify things. But I'm not saying Greek culture is totally outside, because it isn't, because there definitely were Greek aspects in there. We have the organization of Israel, things like the Sanhedrin and stuff like that are adopted from Greek models. So there is an influence there. I'm not saying it isn't there at all. I think the Hebrew and the Jewish aspect, I think, generally are overlooked. And that, I suppose, is what I'm really trying to lift up to the forefront. But I'm not denying the other there at all, by any stretch of the imagination. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Persians were the dominant force. If you look at when you go through the records, it's always the Persians are always recognized as being the larger, the more dominant army in all of that. And I'm sorry about the Medes, you know, but that's how wars go. Yes, in going back to Daniel here. Yeah, well, you know, that's Daniel is another kettle of fish, should I say? Huh? With the Greeks, yes, I did, but there are a great deal of problems with the second half of Daniel concerning time and chronology. But you're absolutely right. He does mimic a lot of what goes on there. And it's interesting as well, I can say this is a footnote. The book of Ezekiel was very interesting because one of the things the book of Ezekiel prophesies is the destruction of Tyre, the ancient city of Tyre. And it describes it, I have to find the reference for you, but it describes this as that I will pick you up and throw you into the sea. That's how it's going to be destroyed. And what's interesting was when Alexander the Great came down, was conquering Tyre. Tyre, I don't know if you know what it looks like, but it's kind of like it has two parts to the city. There was one part of the city which was on the coast, and there was another part which was on an island, quite far down. And they always felt they were indestructible. And what Alexander the Great, he came to Tyre, and in all of the cities he came to, he said, "I have come peacefully. I'm coming to conquer peacefully. Please, you just surrender and everything will be good." Tyre said no. So Alexander the Great basically, in order to get to that island, he took the city of Tyre and he lifted it up, destroyed it, and he threw it into the sea, and he created a walkway all the way in order to get to this island on the sea. And it's exactly as it's described in the book of Ezekiel. The city was turned upside down and thrown into the sea for him to actually reach across. And it's actually a very nice prophecy because it was so practically fulfilled in the life of Alexander the Great. Any other questions? No? Do we have strength to go on? Yes, I think so. I think I could go on, but I don't want to see people dying on me and that. We can just do 5 or 10 minutes. If I go for I stop about every hour or something like that. Yeah, we can stop refreshments and then we'll push on.